Okay, I think we're all set. So, well, good morning, everybody, and it's a great privilege to be here and join you, especially not only the tea, but the most amazing cakes. I just think the conference generally is judged by its cake quality, so definitely a round of applause. Good, so we're carrying on this theme of kind of order, emergence in the universe, multiverse, wherever we are. And hope we still know where we are after that talk. It always stretches my mind, you know, when Rodney gives these talks, you know, when you start thinking about a multiverse. We biologists have our feet firmly on the ground. So this talk will be restricted not only to a single universe, but to this one, and also to this planet. So, you know, it's a very localized kind of talk, really. So, okay, I want to start by providing just a summary, really, of a roadmap of where we're going to go with this talk. First, I'm going to give a brief overview of the idea of progress that's so often been attached to this narrative of biological evolution. And then I'm going to argue that the outcome of that particular discussion doesn't actually have doesn't really make any difference to Christian theology. Okay, so that's going to be my first point. Secondly, I'm going to refer to more recent commentators who've suggested quite loudly that Darwinian evolution is incompatible with any kind of progress or purpose, or maybe both together. And then third of all, I'm going to suggest that in contrast to those commentators, when we look at the recent biological data that we have now, it points to evolution as a highly constrained process, and I'm going to argue that that is consistent with the idea of a God who has intentions and purposes for the created order. So in the dynamic interplay between chance and necessity that characterizes the evolutionary process, I'm going to argue that it's necessity that has, if you like, the upper hand in the whole process. So whatever you might think, therefore, about the ideas of progress in evolution, as far as purpose is concerned, the biological data, I'm going to suggest, do not support those who suggest that evolution is necessarily without purpose. So I'm wording this a little bit carefully, and I hope you'll see the reasons for that as we go along. Okay, let's start by thinking a little bit about progress, this rather slippery word. The idea of evolution, of course, was born in a cultural context in which the idea of progress was a very dominant theme. Evolution as natural history really gets going with Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, who believed in the fixity of species until 1797, but he then became an evolutionist, as he states in his introductory lecture for his new post as professor of lower animals at the newly founded Natural History Museum of Paris in 1800. So Lamarck then followed this up by three major publications in which evolution is presented in very strongly progressionist terms. But ironically, Lamarck himself, he was an ardent materialist, by the way, he was also a convinced uniformitarian. And so to bring these two kind of apparently incompatible ideas together, Lamarck envisaged the continuous spontaneous generation of new species, which then sort of move up this escalator of life, and all the steps on the escalator are occupied at all moments. And this is the primary process. And it's then the differing kind of circumstances, what we call different environments now, on each step, which then leads to different adaptations and consequent variations in all those different species. So for Lamarck, it's this the great escalator of evolution, which is sort of moving everything upwards and onwards, up to the top of the escalator in a great upward direction. Now, it was actually Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, who's poet, rationalist, botanist. To some degree, he foreshadowed Lamarck in his work Zoonomia, and he envisaged that all living animals had arisen millions of years before man from one, what he called a living filament. That was his starting point, which the first great cause had endowed with a potential for delivering, and I quote, improvements by generation to its posterity, well without end. Get a lot of grandiloquent prose in some of these early writers and their ideas about progress. And it was these sort of Lamarckian and Erasmus Darwinian sort of themes. These were picked up by the Scottish publisher Robert Chambers In his then anonymous Vestiges of the Natural History of Creation, 1844, Chambers presented his readers with a developmental hierarchy, which he termed the universal gestation of nature. And this was basically a story of the evolution of just about everything in the sky as swirling fire mist evolved into nebulae, solar systems and planets, on the ground, invertebrates, fish, reptiles, mammals, and man, following up and life's great escalator, a great grandiose scheme of evolution. And in society, there was development in civilization as Negro, Malay, American, Indian, Mongolian, and Caucasian gave way one to the other. So we have a sort of intrinsically racist narrative actually embedded in these sort of ideas. Actually, the book was a total sensation. Indeed, there's a book by Jim Sekor called The Victorian Sensation. And it far outstripped, by the way, the sales of The Origin of Species, as you can see from this graph, until well onwards in the 19th century. Only in the late 19th century do you see the sales of The Origin outstripping this book by Chambers. So the music is wonderful in the background. It sort of improves the ambiance, you know, musical background. I have to tell you a story, actually. This is just, you know, by the by, when they're sorting that out. I was in Brazil at a temple meeting just a few days ago, and I was asked to say grace in the evening in a public cafeteria. And so I stood up and gave my grace, and then the loudspeaker suddenly burst out loudly with a huge applause. It was a bit like a football match, you know. Suddenly somebody had switched it on, and by pure coincidence, talk about coincidences, there was a huge applause, you know, right at the end of the prayer. Sorry, that was just a story in parentheses. Okay, now if we score Lamarck, Erasmus, Darwin, and Chambers, let's score them sort of 9 to 10 on the, if you like, the sort of progressionist stakes, then I suspect Darwin himself, Charles Darwin now himself, I guess he would come in at about 5 on the scale of 1 to 10. Because Darwin was always very temperate in his comments, he was a very cautious man, and he always balanced one comment off with another comment, so sometimes it's difficult to know what he really thought. So on one hand, we find in The Origin of Species, Darwin writing that, and I quote, "As natural selection works solely by and for the good of each being, all corporeal and mental endowments will tend to progress towards perfection." So progress for Darwin was a sort of consequence of the biotic competition going on in what we would now call a particular ecological space. So in crowded ecosystems full of competing life forms, there was a constant removal of the inferior by the superior life forms, and this would impart a kind of progressive direction to evolutionary change in the long run. That's one narrative that you see in the writings of Darwin. But then he writes in his letter to the American progressionist paleontologist Hyatt in 1872, and I quote, "After long reflection," says Darwin, "I cannot avoid the conviction that no innate tendency to progressive development exists." And then we find Darwin scribbling in the margins of another progressionist text, "Never say higher or lower." Okay, so you get this, you know, slightly ambiguous message coming through from Darwin. Now, Darwin's most enthusiastic supporters simply dispensed with any worries about ambiguities, and they adopted a very robustly progressionist view of the evolutionary history. And I guess the best example of that is Herbert Spencer. Here he is. He was arguably, by the way, the most famous philosopher of his time. We forget that now because he's unknown now. But in his day, he was a very well-known philosopher. And he'd already started working out a great Lamarckian scheme for the evolution of nearly everything in his book, Progress, Its Law and Cause, published in 1857, 2 years before The Origin was published. And when The Origin came along, he sort of simply absorbed bits of Darwinian thought into his great Lamarckian scheme. But he remained a Lamarckian for the rest of his life. He never really became a Darwinian. So Spencer maintained that the end point of the evolutionary process, and I quote here, would be the creation of the perfect man in the perfect society, with human beings becoming completely adapted to social life. Now, Darwin himself, as you may know, he didn't use the word evolution at all in the first edition of The Origin of Species, because it sort of carried too much of a sense of progress and unfolding with it, and he didn't like that very much. I mean, he wanted a very strong progressive sort of message, and also evolution was used rather differently to talk about embryology at the time, and the word evolution only starts coming in to later editions of the Origin, and then he uses it in A Descent of Man in 1871. Now, this kind of progressionist narrative that Spencer especially got going out of Darwinian evolution carries on really unabated right through the 20th century. You've got evolutionary thinkers in the first half, such as T.H. Huxley's grandson, Julian Huxley. You've got R.A. Fisher, famous one of the founders of the Neo-Darwinian synthesis. You've got the Catholic Lamarckian paleontologist, theologian Théo de Chardin. And all in their very different ways, sort of keeping this progressionist narrative going during that first half of the 20th century. But then, as Michael Ruse points out, and Ruse has got some very helpful writings in this area, following the development of the Neo-Darwinian synthesis in the 20s and 30s, it now became much less respectable to talk about progression, at least in people's scientific publications. Instead, that kind of material was now relegated, if you like, to their popular writings. So we find, especially in Julian Huxley's very prolific outputs, 1920s, 1950s, that's the period really, we find Huxley becoming attracted to vitalism, the writings of Henry Bergson, and all kinds of strongly progressionist narratives in his earlier writings. A little bit later on, and right in the middle of the Second World War, he became a little more judicious, I think, about some of his comments. And here we find him writing in the conclusion of his book, Evolution, the Modern Synthesis, 1942. Note the date here. He's now tempered it with a kind of realism that you certainly don't find in writers such as Spencer. So here's Huxley writing, evolution is a major factor past evolution, but is limited to a few selected stocks. It may continue in the future, but it is not inevitable. Man, by now become the trustee of evolution, must work and plan if he is to achieve further progress for himself and so for life. And so evolution sort of passes on the baton of progress to man, and then man, began, of course, in those days, has to keep up, you know, the good work. And I, in a sense, will say top marks for optimism to someone writing in 1942. I mean, when you think what was going on at the time. Now, many of the great evolutionary biologists of the latter half of the 20th century, people like Ernst Mayr, who died at the age of 100. By the way, Ernst Mayr published his final scientific paper at the age of 100. Isn't that amazing? That's an example to us all. Yeah, Wilson, of course, Harvard, still very lively and carrying on and so forth. I mean, these are all really arch-progressionists, all these great evolutionary thinkers. They're strongly progressionist. Wilson writes that progress, then, is a property of the evolution of life as a whole by almost any intuitive standard, including the acquisition of goals and intentions in the behavior of animals. Very strong progressionist stance. It's really only when we get to the writings of Stephen Jay Gould we get a sudden kind of reversal in thinking. And here we do really get a sort of vigorous, all-out slaught upon progressionism. In 1989, here's Gould writing that progressionism in evolution is, and I quote, a noxious, culturally embedded, untestable, non-operational, intractable idea that must be replaced if we wish to understand the patterns of history, close quote. So I think we get the impression he was definitely against it. And according to Gould, we are a momentary cosmic accident, albeit a glorious accident. In summing up his view, Gould writes, wind back the tape of life to the early days of the Burgess Shale, let it play again from an identical starting point, and the choice becomes vanishingly small than anything like human intelligence would grace the replay. Now, of course, when you read those strong statements, if you read on, it's a bit like Darwin, actually, you read on in his writings and you find out it's actually not quite as clear as you might first think. And this is in the writings of Gould. So it seems that maybe he moderated his position in his final book, huge great book he wrote called The Structure of Evolutionary Theory. It's published in 1992, just the year before his death, and it's a book of 1,433 pages. So that kind of book really does give you plenty of scope for putting in all the ifs, ands, and buts. Okay, so on page 468, here we find Gould commenting, and I quote, "The history of life includes some manifestly directional properties, and we, have never been satisfied with evolutionary theories that do not take this feature of life into account," close quote. Turns out, therefore, the progressionist accounts that Gould liked to attack most heartily were not, maybe not exactly windmills, but at least items that could leave some forms of sort of progressionist narrative untouched. So he turns out perhaps to be not such an arch anti-progressionist as you might first think. And coming right to the present, or close to the present, here is our old friend Richard Dawkins, and actually coming across as a very strong progressionist in his 1997 review of Gould's book, earlier book called Full House. Dawkins writes, "Progress to mean an increase not in complexity, intelligence, or some other anthropocentric value, but in the accumulating number of features contributing towards whatever adaptation the lineage in question exemplifies. By this definition, adaptive evolution is not just incidentally progressive, it is deeply dyed-in-the-wool, indispensably progressive." Close quote. And then in Dawkins' book, Ancestor's Tale, which actually I think is about one of his best books, in my opinion, we find Dawkins writing that, and I quote, "The accumulative build-up of complex adaptations like eyes strongly suggests a version of progress, especially when coupled in imagination with some of the wonderful products of convergent evolution," close quote, which we'll talk about a bit more in a moment. So that's a very brief thumbnail sketch of, you know, a couple of 100 years, at least a reminder that this is a very long, very complex debate, actually. It's been going on and on and on for a very long time. And the question I really want to ask now is whether the outcome of that discussion, and we've seen different views expressed, does it make any difference, really, to Christian theology? Now, what I would like to call the traditional understanding of evolution starts with thinkers like Charles Kingsley, Frederick Temple, contemporaries of Darwin, pretty much as soon as The Origin of Species is published in 1859, and continues in an unbroken lineage up to the present day. And this tradition represents the evolutionary process as part of God's good creation, used by God in order to bring about his intentions and purposes for biological diversity in general and for humankind in particular. And the phrase humankind in particular here is referring to the fact that humans are made in God's image with a particular relational, functional and role to play in the purposes of God, not least in the caring of God's earth. And so God, in initiating, sustaining this process, is not seen as the divine kind of puppet master, least of all the heavenly engineer who occasionally tinkers with machinery, a picture which you get, I think, from some of the proponents of intelligent design, but rather the God whose immanent faithfulness in guaranteeing the reproducible properties of matter likewise guarantees their propensity for life, the biological diversity which we, of course, as biologists seek to describe and understand. And so in this view, as we've just been hearing from Rodney, creation is about ontology, it's about authorship, it's about the fact that something exists rather than nothing. And I would want to say the traditional interpretation of evolution has been couched. Our Christian interpretation has been very much couched in those terms. Of course, that sense of imminence in God's order was expressed rather wonderfully by many theologians, but here's an example by Calvin in his Institutes, where he wrote, "For it is the Spirit who, everywhere diffused, sustains all things, causes them to grow, and quickens them in heaven and on earth, in transfusing into all things his energy and breathing into them essence, life, and movement. He is indeed plainly divine." I think that's a rather wonderful description of the immanence of God in the created order. Now, I'm not sure that the kind of theological narrative I've just been reflecting upon should commit Christians to any particular theory of progress in evolutionary biology. Now, it depends how you define it, but I think we have to talk about progress in this context in the ways in which it's been used, the way the word's been used in the history of evolutionary theory. Okay, so I'm using progress in a rather historical way, if you like. Of course, you make the word progress mean anything you want, but I'm using it rather circumscribed by its historical usage. And I don't think we need to deny that, you know, prokaryotes such as bacteria remain the most abundant, in many ways, the most successful species ever brought into being, to deny the fact that there's been some sort of progress, or I'm not sure that fact in itself is particularly relevant to a discussion about progress. And I don't think we need to deny or to believe that every evolutionary lineage inevitably tends to develop in the direction of greater complexity. I mean, some do and some don't. There's some very interesting papers out on the way that, generally speaking, in some families, greater complexity is the sort of name of the game. It's what you see. But on the other hand, you know, some things get lost in evolution. I mean, when animals go and live in caves, they don't need eyes, so eyes tend to disappear after a few 100,000 years or so, because they're no longer necessary for living in their particular ecological niche. So, I mean, evolution is a sort of bit of a story about losses and gains, depending on the situation. I certainly don't think we have to believe in any kind of élan vital, some sort of life force that's impressing itself upon evolution and pushing it always upwards and onwards, which is much of the sort of idea you get in Julian Huxley and Herbert Spencer to some extent as well. Instead, I think we can happily accept, in my view anyway, that in evolutionary terms, we're just this sort of small twig on the evolutionary bush. And given, I mean, our lineage passed through a couple of genetic bottlenecks at least, one of them probably only about 12,000 individuals within the human community. I mean, we could so easily not be here. We're just one twig on one branch with many twigs in a giant, great evolutionary tree. And I think we can realize all of that. And I'm not quite sure that it makes much difference to our theological narrative. In other words, I don't think we have to, my own view is, we can come back to this in discussion, we don't have to be committed to some inevitable narrative of progress within the evolutionary history, at least insofar as that word progress has been used in the historical writings about evolution. But what we do, of course, notice is that our twig does have some rather special properties. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here today. The evolutionary process has delivered beings with a kit, if you like, of attributes that do, in fact, render the theological account both feasible and coherent. And these beings, these human beings, they've got big frontal lobes that facilitate cogitation and moral decision-making. They have a basic moral toolkit, I would want to say, which is quite possibly inherited, along with other neuronal machinery of the kind that is specialized for the acquisition of language. And their language and grammar and memory together generate this sort of continuity and development of culture and of its relationships. So clearly these beings have a religious sense, a cognitive bias perhaps to believe in God's agency. Now, many of those characteristics, not a whole list I've just given, but many of the characteristics of humankind just appear numerous times in evolutionary history. I mean, we've got communication, we've got culture, certainly other primates have cultures, we have music, we have creativity. I mean, all in their various forms, these keep popping up all over the place, you know, in evolutionary lineages. But I think it's the particular package of attributes which we've got listed on the slide here, that kind of locate, if you like, the possibility of a responsible relationship to God and real moral responsibilities. And to the best of our knowledge, certainly other animals don't have religion. And we don't take animals or plants, for that matter, to court. And as I say, I think religious belief, although there are some speculation about very speculative ideas, but as far as we know, it is the property of humankind. So that's as a matter of fact, this is what evolution has delivered. And that, of course, we can call that progressive, if you like, if you want to label that. It's progressive in a sense, certainly in terms of comparison with the far more numerous prokaryotes and that kind of thing. But I think equally the recognition of the special qualities of our twig needn't make us deny the intrinsic value of all the other twigs on this wonderful bush of life. It's just that we actually care about the other twigs. They don't care about us. And so obviously that's another human distinctive. Okay, so if theology doesn't commit us to any particular theory of progression, except in these very sort of general terms in which I've outlined, then I do think it acts as a brake on a particular flowering of progressionism. The idea, particularly from the 19th century, early Victorian times really, the idea of progressionism as a sort of inevitable moral progress that was leading, in Spencer's term, to the ultimate human being, that kind of narrative. Now, of course, that sort of narrative was mostly killed off by the horrors of the wars of the 20th century and indeed our present day wars. Amazingly, it still crops up even today. You know, so all this sort of, that kind of progressionism sometimes seems to come back through the back door somehow. And I just think that Christian theology is a good counterweight to that kind of narrative and should introduce a note of realism, especially, of course, through the narrative of the fall, the fact that general moral progress isn't some intrinsic capacity of human beings that they can generate by pulling on their own bootstrings, but can only happen through redemption and through God's grace. Okay, it's a little bit about progress then, rather slippery word. I want to shift now a little bit to think about the other P word in our title, the word purpose. Now, I think it's quite possible to be an ardent progressionist in evolution without believing that the process taken as a whole has any particular ultimate purpose. And that's clearly the position here of Dawkins again. I think he's writing on a possibly rather rainy day in Oxford. I quote, "The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is a bottom no design, no purpose, no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference." Here's Dan Dennett, the philosopher, somewhat agreeing, I think, with this position, and he asks whether the complexity of biological diversity, and I quote, "can really be the outcome of nothing but a cascade of algorithmic processes feeding on chance? And if so, who designed that cascade?" And then it answers his own rhetorical question by saying, "Nobody. It is itself the product of a blind algorithmic process. Evolution is not a process," says Dennett, "that was designed to produce us," close quote. So the discussion here is not really about the question of progression as such, but it's about the question of purpose. That's the word that Dawkins is using here. And I think here we do have to mark clearly a parting of the ways. For clearly the idea of purpose is implicit in the kind of theological, Christian theological framework that we've already been considering. The idea is that indeed the evolutionary process is fulfilling God's creative intentions and purposes. But on the other hand, I so rather agree with Dawkins and Dennett that if you look at the evolutionary process as an atheist, simply through the window of biology, then there is really nothing there that forces upon you a narrative of ultimate purpose. It's a slightly ambiguous narrative. And so without the revelation of God in Christ, there is no framework, no matrix, if you like, within which to place evolutionary history in order to provide it with its overall purpose and coherence. So, does that leave advances in our understanding of evolution sort of completely divorced from our theological understanding of purpose? I would want to say not completely. We certainly can't, in my view, derive theology from the evolutionary process itself, although clearly some have tried to do that. Teilhard de Chardin is a good example. But I do think that our current understanding of biology renders less plausible the suggestion that evolutionary history necessarily lacks any plan or purpose. So I'm using now a traditional scientific approach of counter-evidence. Okay, but thinking about the person, like Dawkins says, it has no purpose at all. I'm not so sure that the current contemporary biological data is consistent with that kind of view. I think it counts against it. And I want to give you eight examples of what I have in mind. So they're going to be brief. I apologize if I'm going to zip through them pretty quickly here. So first and most obviously, evolution as a whole is not a chance process. And this at least is where atheists and theologians, I think, can sing from the same song sheet. As Dawkins writes himself here in The Blind Watchmaker, and I quote in the preface, "One of my tasks will be to destroy," he says, "this eagerly believed myth that Darwinism is a theory of chance." Now, of course, the theory incorporates chance as part of its description in the generation of example, for example, of genomic variation. Of course, there are stochastic events that occur where the species dies out, bad weather, whatever it might be, all that kind of stuff. But the point Dawkins is making here, which I think is perfectly valid, is that the winnowing effect of natural selection ensures that in this finely tuned interaction between chance and necessity, it is actually necessity which wins in the end. And so evolution is a highly organized, in many ways, actually a highly conservative process. Secondly, if you stand back and look at the 3.8 billion years of evolution as a whole, and then this striking increase in biological complexity over that period, it seems to me that this is a narrative inconsistent with the idea of purposelessness on this planet, at least. Because the first 2.5 billion years of biological life on this planet, things rarely got bigger than about 2 millimeters across, okay? And that's about the size of a pinhead, actually about 1 millimeter, about the size of a pinhead. So there were no birds, no flowers, no animals running around, no fish in the sea. But genetically, there was a huge amount going on, of great interest to geneticists anyway, during the first 2.5 billion years. It's only really when you get, of course, to the Cambrian explosion, about 500 million years ago, that you get this wonderful diversification of life forms and things start getting bigger. And finally, of course, you get to us in the last few seconds before midnight on our 24-hour clock, if you like, of that history, with our 10 to the 11 neurons, with our 10 to the 14 synapses, the most complex organ in the universe existing between our ears this morning, a remarkable thought, isn't it? And a mind that is able to get insights into the intelligibility of the universe, as we were just thinking from Rodney's talk. As Sean Carroll from the University of Wisconsin-Madison remarks in a recent review in Nature, and I quote, "Life's contingent history could be viewed as an argument against any direction or pattern in the course of evolution or the shape of life, but it is obvious that larger and more complex life forms have evolved from simple unicellular ancestors and that various innovations were necessary for the evolution of new means of living." Close quote. Third, underlying biological complexity are networking principles that are turning out to be far fewer and simpler than you might imagine from the complexity of cellular organization. I mean, given that in every cell there are very complex networks of molecules operating for replication and in order for that cell metabolism to function properly, I find this actually quite surprising. Yuri Allon from the Weizmann Institute comments, this again is from Nature, "Biological networks seem to be built to a good approximation from only a few types of patterns called network motifs. The same small set of network motifs discovered in bacteria have been found in gene regulation networks across diverse organisms, including plants and animals. Evolution seems to have rediscovered the same motifs again and again in different systems." We can link this, I think, to what Sean Carroll again has called deep homology. Deep homology, that means that if you look at complex organs in animals, such as limbs and eyes, things like that, in many cases it's possible to track back their evolutionary histories to see how those structures arose by the modification of pre-existing genetic regulatory circuits. And these were established very early in animal development, hence this term, deep homology. Fourthly, the very limited array of protein structures used by living organisms compared to the astronomically huge number of possible structures, I think is also very striking indeed. So proteins, as you know, are made up of a specific sequence of 20 amino acids. The average protein contains around 300 amino acids. That means that there are 20 to the 300 possible different proteins, or more than 10 to the 300. So sometimes biologists suffer from kind of number envy when they look at cosmologists, but I think these are, you know, fairly astronomically and cosmologically huge sort of numbers. Because if you took only a single molecule, let's imagine you had 10 to the 300 proteins, and you only had one molecule of each one. Somebody's calculated, it's not my calculation, that there isn't room in the known universe to fit them all in. Okay, so there we have some big numbers too in biology. But also what's interesting that if you look at the actual structural motifs used in proteins, they turn out to be rather few in number. I mean, first of all, there's only about, you know, a few tens of thousands of proteins that are actually used in all living organisms. I mean, it's a tiny, tiny number when you compare it to 10 to the 390. And then if you look at all the structures that have been published in all those X-ray diffractive beautiful protein structures published so far, what you find is that the great majority can be assigned to only around 1,400 protein domain families. So in other words, all living things are united not just by having the same genetic code, but also by possessing this sort of elegant, highly restricted set of protein structures. I think that's very remarkable. And a lot of recent literature suggests that proteins can only evolve along certain quite restricted pathways because of the internal constraints that are built into their own structures and the need, of course, for them to maintain their functionality. And so here's one example. Darwinian evolution, say these authors, in a science paper, can follow only very few mutational paths to fit to proteins. Won't get into the detail, but here's their conclusion in the abstract, and they say, we conclude that much protein evolution will be similarly constrained. This implies that the protein type of life may be largely reproducible and even predictable. So-called fitness landscapes also play a very large role in evolutionary discourse. So these traditionally represent topographical pictures, of the adaptation of different populations to local ecological niches. But here's an article published recently in Nature, referring now to fitness landscapes in terms of enzyme evolution and function again. It turns out the evolutionary pathways to arrive at a particular function of this enzyme they're looking at in this paper are remarkably constrained. There are only kind of few ways to get up the hill, if you like, to the top of the fitness hill. As the authors conclude, that only a few paths are favoured also implies that evolution might be more reproducible than is commonly perceived or even be predictable. I find it surprising, that word predictable, it was heresy in when I was doing biochemistry, way back when, to talk about predictability in evolutionary biology. But now the word's been creeping in again through these various papers. And a much more recent example here, fitness landscapes are also playing a role in the evolution of the RNA machinery that regulates gene expression. That means the switching on and off of genes and so on. Just a few months ago, I found a very exciting discovery published in Nature that there are actually circular RNA molecules, a whole new class of thousands of different RNA molecules, which in turn have the function of suppressing the actions of another class of RNA molecules called microRNAs. And the paper that came out in Nature in March this year gave two examples of circular RNA, and they contain around 70 binding sites for microRNAs which have been conserved over evolutionary history. So here we have another fitness landscape again, which displays the constraints between all these various species of regulatory RNA molecules. It's really an amazing system, but it's highly constrained. Things can't just go anywhere they want. And fifthly, as with proteins and RNA molecules, so with genes, there are underlying biological principles that constrain the location and type of gene evolution. And so the raw material for evolution, if you like, is provided by random mutations, by gene flow, by genetic recombination that occurs during the generation of the germline cells. But note that randomness here means only that genetic variation occurs without the needs or otherwise of the particular organism in mind. By contrast, the genetic variation that leads to evolution is not really random in the sense that any kind of variation in any kind of gene will do. In reality, there are so-called hotspot genes, those that are far more likely than others to play key roles in evolutionary change. And here's an example, a gene that delights in the name of Shaven Baby. It's found in the Drosophila fruit fly, that great organism much beloved by geneticists. And these sort of genes act as kind of input-output genes. They're encoding key switching proteins that integrate whole sets of information that are then mediated to downstream effectors. And so the Shaven Baby gene regulates the existence and distribution of these fine trichomes, they're called, or cellular hairs, on the surface of the larvae of Drosophila. So that mutations in Shaven Baby lead to this lack of hairs, hence the name. So it's those genes such as Shaven Baby, these are the hotspot genes that render evolution possible, because they're regulating now a whole integrated program of events. In this case, they're converting cells into hair-making cells. And so the mutations that occur are in the regulatory sequence of this gene, and that controls how much of the protein is actually made, so it titrates it up and down. And so far, around 350 of these hotspot genes have been identified in plants and animals. And so as the authors of a recent review in Nature again, entitled "Is Genetic Evolution Predictable?" comment, I quote, "Recent observations indicate that all genes are not equal in the eyes of evolution. Evolutionarily relevant mutations tend to accumulate in hotspot genes and at specific positions within genes. Genetic evolution is constrained by gene function, the structure of genetic networks, and population biology. The genetic basis of evolution may be predictable to some extent." Here again, the heretical word popping up yet again. Sixthly, there is the remarkable example of evolutionary convergence. That's the repeated evolution in independent biological lineages of the same biochemical pathways or organs or structures, and we've already quoted from Dawkins on that point. You may be familiar with a book by the Cambridge paleobiologist Simon Comyn-Morris, who's drawn attention to these wonderful convergences in evolution in his book Life Solution: Inevitable Humans in a Lonely Universe. If you don't know that book, I thoroughly recommend it. And so what Morris does in his book is to bring together hundreds and hundreds of examples of what's happened in evolutionary history. For example, the convergence or mimicry of insects and spiders to an ant morphology has evolved at least 70 times independently in different lineages. Compound and camera eyes taken together have evolved more than 20 times during the course of evolution, because if you live on a planet with light and darkness, you're going to need eyes. So eyes are what you're going to get. And my own personal conviction is, when we find life on some other exoplanet, providing evolution has gone on long enough and it has light or darkness, which it probably will, things will have eyes. And there are hundreds and hundreds of other examples, if you're interested in convergence, in this wonderful website directed by Simon called www.mapoflife.org. And there you can get many, many more examples. So in a commentary, remember that quote from Gould I was giving earlier, Gould in a very anti-progressionist mode. So in this commentary on Gould's idea of contingency, Simon Comyn-Morris writes that it is now widely thought that the history of life is little more than a contingent muddle punctuated by disastrous mass extinctions, that in spelling the doom of one group so open the doors of opportunity to some other mob of lucky chances. Rerun the tape of the history of life and the end result will be an utterly different biosphere. Most notably, there will be nothing remotely like a human. Of course, Morris is a little bit taking off Stephen Jay Gould. Yeah, they had a bit of a discussion when Gould was still alive. Yet, as Morris goes on to say, what we know of evolution suggests the exact reverse. Convergent is ubiquitous, and the constraints of life make the emergence of the various biological properties, e.g. intelligence, very probable, if not inevitable. So yes, the rolling of the genetic dice, it's a wonderful way of generating both novelty and diversity, but at the same time, it appears to be constrained by necessity. So if we sort of, in this little model here, we just picture all the possible genomes that you could possibly generate as those little red boxes. If you like, evolution is like a search engine searching for the design space of the green boxes, that is to say the genomes that will generate organisms that will flourish in particular ecological niches on planet Earth. And so in a way, evolutionary history is a history of lineages going down the little green boxes because of these severe constraints, all kinds of constraints at different levels in the evolutionary narrative. Only some things can happen, it turns out. Not in some kind of deterministic way, but in a highly constrained way. The seventh example I'd like to give relates to cooperativity. And the emergence of cooperation in living organisms emerges very, very early in the history of life. In fact, Martin Novak of Harvard has recently suggested that cooperation should be added to gene mutation plus natural selection as the third key feature of Darwinian evolution. And cooperation, of course, is rife in the living world just everywhere you look. Wolves that hunt in packs, birds that migrate in perfect V formations, there's hundreds of thousands of starlings that make wonderful patterns as they wheel and turn over the evening sky, meerkats that gang together to scare off intruders, social insects such as bees and ants. I mean, we could go on and on about cooperation. Now, perhaps we think less often of cooperation at the cellular level, but, you know, that's a big deal as well at that level. Because the earliest fossils that we have are actually stromatolites, dating from the earliest about 3.5 billion years ago, which are great mats of bacteria. They've learned how to live in cooperative colonies. So cooperation is there very early in evolutionary history. And the transition from unicellular to multicellular life itself represents a dramatic increase in cooperation. Multicellularity, by the way, has evolved multiple times, not just once, many, many times in different lineages. For example, the roughly 50 different extant species of volvocene algae, which I've illustrated here on this slide, illustrate, in fact, all the various stages of this evolutionary history, ranging from those that live as single cells to those that live in these large multicellular colonies, such as you can see on the right-hand side there of the screen. And those first multicellular colonies start appearing in the Triassic period, about 220 million years ago. And what happened is the extracellular matrix glycoproteins began to bond the cells together, the single unicells together, in a kind of circular morphology in which each cell plays its role for the good of the whole colony. And then, in a subset of lineages, some cells began to specialize in motility. Others began to specialize in reproduction. And there are some species in which the dominant cells actually are specializing in motility rather than reproduction and so forth. And of course, in our own bodies today, we have more than 200 specialized cell types all living together happily and collaborating and cooperating most of the time in terms of generating us as living bodies. So cooperation is absolutely central to the history of evolution. The eighth and final example I want to give refers to the emergence of the human mind. I mean, really, only a highly ordered and constrained process could produce something as elegant, as complex, as highly organized as the human mind that can play the organ so beautifully and generate music. I mean, you know, this has got to be a very organized process. And personhood developed in evolution with increased self-awareness. It's a gradual process that emerges in evolutionary history and what we now call a theory of mind, in turn dependent upon the very rapid increase in brain size that's taken place over the past 2 million years of evolutionary history. And so in this understanding, mind is an emergent phenomenon, meaning that something with totally new properties has emerged which cannot be adequately understood or described using the language of biology. I mean, only 2 million years ago did hominin brain size begin to seriously surpass that of our nearest living cousins, the chimpanzee, which continues to have a brain size of about 400 cubic centimeters. Bipedality does not appear to be the critical factor that has driven this rapid cultural evolution. For certainly the hominins, who left their fossilized footprints in the volcanic ash at Laetoli in Tanzania 3.5 million years ago, were bipedal. First stone tools don't really start appearing until 2.6 million years ago, And so bipedalism and tool use may be necessary, but not sufficient to explain the rapid brain evolution that came a little bit later. And probably a more likely explanation for this rapid evolution is the increased complexity of hominin social life, the need for cooperativity, the need for keeping track of different individuals with hunting groups and that sort of thing. Bit speculative, but that's the current idea. And so increasing brain size was characterized by an increase as well in the numbers of orders of intentionality. This is a phrase coming, of course, from the theory of mind, the ability of our own minds to realize that there are other minds that think like ours and have intentions and purposes that might be similar or even quite different from ours. And we take this mind reading now completely for granted, but it is in fact a crucial aspect of our being and indeed to have religious beliefs. For example, and this is an example from Robin Dunbar, he gives the example that with each level of intentionality up to 4 or 5, we then generate the possibility of religious belief. In this example, I suppose, he says that you think that I believe that there is a God who intends to influence our futures because he understands our desires. That's 5 orders of intentionality. Dunbar speculates that at least 4 orders of intentionality are necessary for religious belief and probably wouldn't have appeared until around 500,000 years ago, about the time of the emergence of archaic Homo sapiens. He reckons, and this is speculative stuff, he reckons the 5th order of intentionality wouldn't have arisen until you get the kind of brain size associated with our own species, which emerged around 200,000 years ago. So here's a comment from Novak, professor at Harvard University, and it's very striking in this context. Novak's published a lot recently on the evolution of game theory in the context of social cooperation. And he comments, in 2009, in a review, my position is very simple. Evolution has led to a human brain that can gain access to a platonic world of forms and ideas, close quote. So here's again, you know, just think Plato's been ushered out the front door in 19th century biology, and hey, lo and behold, beginning of 21st century biology, Plato comes into the back door again. Well, it's fascinating, isn't it? So if we take those 8 examples of order and constraint from our contemporary understanding of biology, I think it's very clear that the evolutionary history is far from being purely stochastic and random. It looks highly organized, it looks constrained, perhaps it has inevitable outcomes. It's difficult, I think, to use the word inevitability. But note that I'm not suggesting that if we read the evolutionary narrative just as biology, that therefore evolutionary history per se displays some ultimate purpose. I'm trying to make here, I think, a rather more modest claim that these kinds of data and many more render the claim that evolutionary history is necessarily a purposeless history less plausible. In science, it's often data that count against a theory or an idea that are most powerful, as Popper, of course, was fond of pointing out. I mean, when we experience something as humans which is highly ordered and constrained, then we normally associate it with some kind of purpose. That's what we normally do. And so we can finish with the kind of comments we frequently make in the discussion sections of our papers, that our data are consistent with our particular model, whatever that happens to be. So it seems to me this highly organized and constrained evolutionary history, resulting in the emergence of rational minds that can, to some extent, appreciate the intelligibility of the universe, is consistent with the theological claim that there is a God who has intentions and purposes for the world. And likewise, the emergence of tool use, cooperation, creativity, personal relationships, love, music, art, on and on we could go with the list, I think also seems to me to be very consistent with the presence of a Trinitarian God, and I say presence, the one who's immanent in the created order, God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit, within whom loving relationship has always existed for all eternity. So in my view, Martin Novak is right. Mind, a personal mind, is primary, if you like, and evolution is God's search engine discovering again and again facets of God's mind in the created order. Now, of course, we cannot recognize those facets without the help of the roadmap provided by God's revelation of himself in the Bible, but armed with that roadmap, then I think the created order speaks loudly of the ways of the Creator. And with that thought, I think I will close and just say that here we are sitting on our very small twig. We might so easily have gone extinct, and we are here by God's grace. I will finish on that note. Thank you very much.
I hope you've enjoyed this podcast from Faith and Thought. Next year's symposium will be on the 18th of October, and we'll look at the important subject of homosexuality from biblical, scientific, and pastoral aspects. So we look forward to seeing you there if possible.